Of resistance and truth shed light on the realities on the ground in conflict zones, the realities which have been repeatedly ignored by mainstream media outlets of the West, led by the United States. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Palestinians in Gaza, including resistance factions, non-governmental organizations, academics, as well as civil society groups, held a national conference on Sunday to condemn the Aqaba summit. The meeting between Israeli and the Palestinian Authority officials was held in the Jordanian Red Sea Resort of Aqaba. It was also attended by representatives from the United States and Egypt. The spokesman for Hamas resistance movement said that the Aqaba summit aims to cover up the Israeli regime's ongoing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The Aqaba security summit will only harm the Palestinian cause and aims to abort the simmering uprising in the West Bank and Al-Quds. The participation of the Palestinian Authority in this summit only indicates the resumption of security cooperation with the occupying regime. We call on all countries to hold an international conference to support the rights of the Palestinian people.
The summit comes only days after Israeli regime forces killed around a dozen Palestinians and wounded some 90 others in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. In its final communique, the conference in Gaza stressed the importance of increasing all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation and protecting occupied Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
All forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation all over Palestine are legitimate and will continue to increase despite all conspiracies and challenges. We also warn the Israeli regime against playing with fire and violating the sanctity of Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians maintain that the Aqaba summit aims to sow seeds of division among Palestinians and to suppress resistance groups in the occupied West Bank.
The Aqaba meeting, which is going to be held today with the sponsorship of the Americans, Egypt, Jordan, and that will include Israel and the Palestinian Authority, is intended, in my opinion, to resume security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And also, I think it's intended to crack down on Palestinian resistance.
Many Palestinians believe that the Palestinian Authority has become a haven for small Palestinian factions that have long abandoned the path of resistance against the Israeli occupation. Since the start of this year, over 60 Palestinians, including 13 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Analysts say the Aqaba summit will only give Tel Aviv the green light to kill and maim more Palestinians. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The current world is facing many environmental troubles like climate change, dust storms, and pollution. In this regard, the Center for Political and International Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran has organized its first national conference on diplomacy and cross-border environmental challenges.
This conference would be a very good turning point for going forward to raise the, awareness, global, the national awareness on what is going on, in terms of climate change impacts, in terms of, transboundary rivers, in terms of marine pollutions and sand and dust storms. This is the main objective of this session.
The four main issues discussed in the event were diplomacy and climate change, diplomacy and solutions on how to deal with the dust phenomenon, diplomacy and sustainable management of rivers and common water resources, and diplomacy and pollution of the Caspian Sea, Persian Gulf, and Oman Sea.
This conference is considered the biggest environmental event in Iran due to the comprehensiveness of the topics discussed as well as the number of speakers and participants.
The first national conference on diplomacy and transboundary environmental challenges was held in the presence of the Iran Minister of Energy and the head of environmental organization at the Office of the Political and International Studies of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Also, several prominent speakers examined different dimensions of cross-border environmental challenges and presented their proposed solutions for the development of environmental diplomacy in the framework of separate and parallel roundtables. The head of Iran's Department of Environment hailed the efforts made to tackle the country's environmental challenges.
The general approach of the 13th government is that it sees environmental diplomacy as a precursor to political diplomacy. Fortunately, we've seen its results and achievements in the last year and a half. Considering the policies of the government that cooperation with neighboring countries is on the agenda, we saw this cooperation at a very good level, especially with the holding of the regional ministerial meeting of environmental cooperation for a better future in Tehran last year. God willing, the statute of the regional environmental fund is being discussed between the countries of the region, and based on this important achievement, the United Nations thanked Iran in its recent resolution and introduced the Islamic Republic as the host of the International Conference on Combating Sand and Dust Storms in 2023.
The achievements of the First National Conference on Diplomacy and Cross-Border Environmental Challenges will be useful in the process of decision-making and adopting new policies in the country's environmental sectors. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
An official delegation from the Arab Interparliamentary Union has met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said the visit shows there are Arab institutions still capable of taking action for the interest of Arab people. He also thanked those countries for their rapid response in assisting Syrians following the earthquake. The head of the union expressed solidarity with the Syrian people, underlining the importance of taking necessary action to ensure Syria's return to playing an active role in the Arab world. The delegation, which includes heads of parliaments of the UAE, Egypt, Libya, Jordan, and Palestine, then headed to the Syrian parliament, where they met with its speaker, Hamoud Sabbagh.
We represent Arab people. This is a historic visit. We wanted to convey a message of support to the brotherly Syrian people. We had a high-level meeting with President Assad, who is a highly educated person. We had a rich dialogue with him. We were glad to meet him. In brief, we came to say that the people we represent support Syria.
Members of the delegation called for the restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, promising to exert all efforts for that purpose. They expressed readiness to offer all the help needed to alleviate the people's suffering after the devastating earthquake that hit the country, while calling for all sanctions crippling Syria's economy to be lifted.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has intensified its invasions against Palestinians as part of a pattern of extrajudicial assassination of Palestinian resistance fighters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, on February 23rd, city streets in the West Bank, East Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip were silent. Palestinians had declared a general strike and a day of mourning in light of the Zionist regime's invasion of one of the West Bank's most ancient cities the day before, which left 11 Palestinians dead and over 102 people injured. On the morning of February 22nd, the Zionist regime forces invaded Nablus. It started with an undercover special operations unit, infiltrating the old city in the early dawn hours. searching for fighters from the Lion's Den resistance group. Hours later, the Special Operations Force located two resistance fighters that had just walked into Habala quarter of the old city. Hossam Bassam Islam, 24, and Muhammad Omar Jonaidi Abu Bakr, 23. By approximately 10 a.m., the undercover Israeli regime teams moved in for the kill. An armed confrontation ensued as the two fighters were holed up in a house in the city. The Zionist regime special forces summoned reinforcements 20 minutes into the operation, and that's when the larger-scale onslaught began, as the Zionist regime's military vehicles flooded the city. According to eyewitnesses from Nablus and Balata refugee camp, more than 50 Israeli regime military vehicles launched a full-fledged land invasion of Nablus while imposing a closure on entry and exit points to the city. Three fighters were killed during the confrontation in Habala quarter, as a third comrade of Jonaidi and Islam, 23-year-old Walid Dakhil, had joined the fight in the middle of the exchange of fire. Other resistance fighters from Nablus-based resistance groups, such as Nablus Brigade and Balata Brigade, were also killed during armed confrontations with the Zionist regime's military throughout the city. All the while, the Zionist regime's army conduct throughout the city was violent and indiscriminate, as the Israeli troops fired at bystanders and killed several non-combatants, while injuring countless others. By 1:30 p.m., the army began its retreat, leaving devastation in its wake. All told, the Zionist regime army killed 11 Palestinians in Nablus, 10 on the day of invasion, with the 11th succumbing to his wounds the following day. More than 100 Palestinians were injured, including at least three journalists. 85 of the injuries were with live ammunition, with six in critical condition, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Seven of the slain were resistance fighters, identified as Muhammad Khaled Anbusi, 25, Tamar Nemr Ahmad Menavi, 33, Mus'ab Munir Muhammad Uwais, 26, Jasser Jamil Abdul Wahab Qanar, 23, Hossam Basim Islam, 24, Walid Riaz Hossein Dakhil, 23, and Muhammad Abu Bakr Jonaidi, 23. The other four Palestinian non-combatants were killed by the Israeli regime army throughout the invasion. Three of them were elderly men, identified as Adnan Sabah Bara, 72, Abdul Hadi Abdul Aziz Al Ashqar, 61, and 66-year-old Anan Sakwat Anab, who died the day following the invasion from respiratory injuries due to the tear gas inhalation. The fourth non-combatant was a minor, identified as Muhammad Farid Sha'ban, 16. According to the Zionist regime's military, two Israeli troops were also injured during the confrontations. The Zionist regime army said the extrajudicial assassination mission was launched upon receiving intelligence concerning the whereabouts of Muhammad Jonaidi and Hossam Islam, who were wanted by the Shin Bet. The home where the armed youth had made their last stand now lies in ruins, water pipes flooding the area. Standing on the rubble of what was once a staircase, a friend and comrade of Jonaidi shows people a video of the slain man from the night before. Remains of the man's last meal can be seen among the rubble. When they were encircled in Habala quarter of the old city, Islam and Jonaidi were in the company of another younger resistance fighter Walid Dakhil, 23. Dakhil's body was riddled with bullets. Although not the target, he confronted the troops in an attempt to help his friends survive. Moving slowly and gently with his friends in his jacket, Dakhil's younger brother looked a lot like the photos of Walid. He was so loving, Dakhil told Mundo Weiss, as he moved to the site of his brother's assassination. Guiding the way toward the Habala quarter of the old city, Walid's 21-year-old brother clenched his jaw when recalling the slaughter of that morning. His chin seemed to unlock only as he shared tidbits of his brother in more intimate settings with friends. "He loved life," he said. "My brother, he loved life," he repeated, in case it didn't resonate the first time. "He loved to laugh." Walid's younger sibling interjected, chuckling, saying, "He used to always crack jokes to make those around him laugh too." The Zionist regime military claimed the three men had posed a threat to the Israeli lives, albeit without providing evidence. At the same time, the Shin Bet claims that the Lion's Den no longer poses a serious threat to the Zionist regime. Additional statements from the Zionist regime military justified the extrajudicial assassination on the grounds that the men had refused to turn themselves in. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported that recently, Israeli extremist settlers committed about 300 violations against Palestinians and their properties in the towns of Hawara, Burin, Asira al-Qabliya, south of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, Hassan Douglas, who monitors settlement activities in the northern West Bank. Douglas told Wafa that Israeli settlers recently launched a massive attack against Palestinians, burning houses, assaulting citizens, which resulted in the killing of a Palestinian man identified as Sameh Akbash, 37, and injuring more than 100 others. He added that the Zionist settlers targeted 30 houses, stoning some and burning down ours in Hawara. The fanatic settlers also burned 15 vehicles. Douglas noted that the settlers burnt a barn, three vehicles, an attempt to set fire to a house in Burin, while in Asira al-Qabliya, the Zionist settlers burned a house and a water tank and caused damages to vehicles in Odala town.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Germany has expelled two Iranian diplomatic staff. The reason, Iran's sentencing to death of a German-Iranian national who has confessed to terrorism charges. Iran has responded to Germany's move in kind, but why would Germany show support for a terrorist group ringleader and, by default, the terrorist responsible for Iranian deaths? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Germany's relations with Iran and why it has adopted a hostile approach towards the Islamic Republic. Our guests for this edition of the program include Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us is Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist who joins us from Houston, Texas. Welcome to you both. Elijah Magner, first over to you. We're looking at an expulsion executed by Germany of the two diplomats over Iran's sentencing of a German-Iranian national to death, which was over terrorism charges. And, of course, then Iran has in kind done the same in terms of two of the German that they have expelled, these two German diplomats. First of all, in terms of the act itself by Germany, isn't that a direct interference in Iran's internal affairs, including its judicial affairs?
It is indeed. It is an interfering in Iran domestic affairs, and this is not something that any country should do with another country. However, in the West, they have used to behave in a way where they think they can do what they want, and other countries are not allowed to retaliate in the same way. So if Germany is concerned about the move that Iran has done by expelling two German diplomats from Tehran, it should have thought about its move from the first beginning. And I think this tension is not related to the expelling diplomat from one side or another. It goes much deeper than that. It is the coalition of the U.S. and the EU together against Iran, trying to intimidate Iran, trying to put pressure on the Islamic Republic. And we cannot exclude this fact from the Iranian support to Russia and the JCPOA, because the nuclear deal is in limbo and because the West is not abiding by its promise and its commitment, then they find all the excuses to escalate the tension.
Is the U.S. asking or is the U.S. dictating to Germany?
I think the U.S. is dictating to all the West. The U.S. is dictating to Brussels, to Germany, to France, to every single European nation here. And we have seen this is not related only to Iran, but is also involving a kind of going toward a third world war, where the U.S. is dragging everybody behind. And if we look at the relationship between Iran and the EU, we see a more positive approach by the EU. However, we see a more negative approach by the U.S. And then when the EU consider, by the announcement of Josep Borrell, who is the vice president of the EU Commission, saying that the Iran is bringing out a reasonable demand to reach the JCPOA deal, then we hear the Americans saying, well, no, it doesn't agree with us. And then the EU just stop talking and abide by the U.S. dictate. Uh-huh. So anything that is coming out of the EU is really, the EU has become a spokesperson of the U.S.
All right, Mohsen Naqvi, we're talking about this a man by the name of Jamshid Sharmad, who is basically a terrorist. He's confessed to his role in acts of a U.S.-based terror group. The name is Tondar. The group itself is accused of planning and conducting terrorist activities inside of Iran. And based on what our guest there, Elijah Magner, says, if you agree, I'm wondering what the context of the conversation would be if the U.S. is directing or dictating Germany. What is it saying to Germany? You need to defend this terrorist and therefore come and expel two diplomats, maybe? I mean, Germany says we do not accept the massive violation of the rights of a German citizen. The man's a terrorist. He's got blood on his hands. So it's pretty clear. What's your perception of the way that these two, if you agree, are colluding with each other to carry out the defense, in this case, of this terrorist?
They definitely are colluding with each other. Germany is taking its instructions from the U.S. empire, and that goes on to really think as to how sovereign the European Union or how sovereign Germany is in itself. But before I kind of dive into that, even when you collude or you want to somehow corner your enemies, so to speak, you need to do it in a fashion that is slightly smart. This is such a, and for the lack of a better word, a dumb way to get back at your enemies. Because what's Germany trying to say? What's the message that Germany is giving? Number one, do they not accept the constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran? Because the sentence is in line with the system that the constitution has confirmed, which is it goes on to reflect the will of the Iranian people and goes on to accept Islam, in essence. The second possibility is that Germany is saying that German citizens are incapable of espionage, that German citizens are incapable of committing crimes. You see, the thing is that in Germany, there is no capital punishment. And that's why they take capital punishment very seriously. But one may argue that the reason why capital punishment was abolished in the late 1940s was primarily to cleanse Germany off of the crimes that Hitler had committed in World War II. So there was this agenda that they had when they abolished the criminal punishment in Germany. Having said that, Germany's silence when the United States executes innocent people in the U.S., or the fact that in the United States of America, the penalty for espionage can go up till the death penalty, and the fact that Germany is silent over that, it's quite clear that this is not an issue of policy, that this is not an issue of principle, but rather it's an issue of bullying a state that has become sovereign, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran. It goes on to make our narrative more concrete that Germany is taking instructions from the U.S. empire and is not sovereign itself. And there's no doubt that they are both colluding. I mean, Sharmad was arrested in 2020. The Iranian system of justice took its time. They took their time before they gave out their sentences. It was not a matter of arrest and then execute. They have done their investigations. This person was arrested, and he's responsible for killing more than 14 to 15 people and injuring more than 200 people in Shiraz.
All right. We need to cover this aspect of this terrorist group, Elijah Magnier, and bring to light the association this terrorist had in terms of its dictates to the group. First of all, the group is known as Tundar, and it's also called Kingdom Assembly of Iran. And what they want to do is the restoration of the ousted monarchy at any cost. And one of the things that this Sharmad has said, will show no mercy to anyone. Our stance concerning the overthrow of the Islamic Republic is quite clear. It's fist and bullet. Seven embassies in Iran will be annihilated. So when you hear that, Elijah Magnier, and perhaps people who are listening, doesn't that somewhat correlate to the way that some of this type of approach was infiltrated within the rioters? Because those are similar to some of the sentiments that these rioters have echoed in their protests, in the most recent protests or rioting that took place in Iran. It eerily sounds similar. So do you think that there's a connection there?
I think it goes deeper than that. Because since 1979, the Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a different position, looking after its own constitution, the interest of the country, and no longer be submitted to the US general dominance of the world. This is where the West is behaving in a way that there is a need to change the ruling system in Iran. And when Joe Biden just a few months ago said, we want to free Iran, so he said by saying that he wants to free Iran, it means he wants to change the regime system, which means that this is a clear intervention in the Iranian affair. This is a violation of international laws and the UN Charter, not respecting the will of the population of Iran that elected their government and chose themselves with a referendum what kind of ruling system they have. If there is any change that needs to be done in Iran, it will be up to the Iranian people living in Iran to cast their vote and show the parliament and show the constitution and make any changes that they want. It's not up to the West to interfere in Iran's affair, support riots, finance terrorist organization. There are so many other organizations that are financed by the West, MEC, and then you can name several others. And then you have also all the sabotage that the Israelis and the intelligence services of the Mossad and the West is doing. So all that falls into one box. At the end of the day, they want Iran to submit. And when there is a deal between Iran and the West, when there is an agreement, all these small groups will disappear. But they have to agree to respect the Iranian sovereignty, and they have to bring back all the assets that they are confiscating that belongs to Iran, and respect the Iranian will and the will of the population.
Sure. Well, recently, Mohsen Naqvi, we've had Iranian officials, including Iran's leader, who have, and the military top brass, many officials from there, and also intelligence ministries that have said that the U.S. and Europe have been dealt a very heavy blow when it comes to the incentives they had behind the riots and the way that that they backed it, that their defeat is very evident. Do you feel that this is what Germany has done is a backlash, that it's in response to the defeat that they have suffered, a humiliating one, at the hands of Iran, and therefore it's come out condemning the sentence that was placed against this terrorist, and in turn expelling the two Iranian diplomats?
Absolutely. I think all of these measures are desperate. These are desperate tactics that the West is now using against the sovereign Islamic Republic of Iran. And they have been defeated on so many fronts, diplomatic fronts, military fronts, that now they just need an excuse to somehow criticize an action of the sovereign government. This has been the attitude of the West. You either agree with us or you're against us. So any respectful nation, any respectable nation, would never bow down to this, to the bullying tactics of the West, especially of the U.S. empire. I mean, the hypocrisy that we see on part of the U.S. empire and its Western allies, that in false pretext, they go and attack Afghanistan after 9/11, and in false pretext, they go and attack and kill millions of innocent Iraqis in the false pretext of weapons of mass destruction, which they never found. And yet, there has been no repercussions by the International Courts of Justices against George W. Bush or against Tony Blair, for that matter. So this goes on to show the hypocrisy. And let's not forget that Europe, and specifically Germany, was a party to the attacks that were made upon Iraq and Afghanistan. Germany was a party to that. So the hypocrisy of the West in general should be criticized, and international courts of justice should finally open their eyes and take actions against the crimes that the West has committed against the innocent people of the world. And when we see protests happening in Iran, when we see organizations like Mujahideen-e-Khalq, when we see organizations like Tundar go and attack innocent Iranians, it is the very right of the Islamic Republic, and the Islamic Republic owes that to the Iranian nation to bring those people to justice who have committed these heinous crimes against the Iranians. Why this hypocrisy? No one should have the right to dictate local policy to any sovereign nation, and I think hats off to Iran for not bowing down to the U.S. empire, for playing their game in their own area by doing tit-for-tat and expelling German diplomats just the way they did. So this is the only language that the arrogant powers understand.
Sure. Well, another issue, Elijah Magni, is the fact that Germany has raised the issue of human rights. And it's gone after that issue quite vociferously when it comes to Iran. And they've even ratified a plan under the guise of supporting human rights, and of course this is in order to put pressure on the Islamic Republic. But I think Germany's forgetting that Iranians are not going to forget the way that Germany actually supplied Iraq's Saddam Hussein with 6,000 worth of chemical weapons of one kind or another during the Iran-Iraq war. That's something Iranians are not going to forget. And, you know, when they go and they sanction Iran that way, kind of a message does that send in the way that Germany is behaving when it comes to Iran?
Well, I think the mere fact that Iran is responding in a kind of tit for tat, it sends a strong message to the West that you can't think of doing an act that is violating the sovereignty of another country and not expect a similar or even harsher reaction depending on what the foreign policy is of Iran. This was a very important message that Iran is sending back. Now, what happened during the Iran-Iraq war, every single country in the West, including some Arab states, supported Saddam Hussein because they wanted really to defeat Iran, and they didn't really acknowledge the will of the population with the Islamic Republic. However, the people of Iran and the diplomacy of Iran is willing to put that on the side as long as the other country in the West, particularly Germany, France, Italy, and other countries, really respect Iranian sovereignty and Iranian integrity. Now, in this case, what Germany is doing, Germany is leading the way in Europe to follow the U.S. policy, not only against Iran, but we've seen it also in other issue. This is why it is not surprising to see tens of thousands of German and French and Spaniard in the street manifesting against their government, because there is a big gap today between the population and their leaders. So the decisions that are taken by the leaders in Europe today, we can see that all these decisions are incompatible with the interests of the European population. And showing such an aggressivity toward Iran is not beneficial to the European population. Making business with Iran, having good relationship with Iran, is in the benefit of the Iranian, of the European industry and the European economy that is suffering dearly, particularly with the war today between the U.S. and Russia on the Ukrainian soil, and all the sanctions that we have taken here in Brussels and are having the boomerang effect. So we really don't need another front with Iran and start meddling in Iranian affairs and then getting a hit back and then having bad relationship when we are desperately in need to restore the relationship with other countries, particularly when we see today that Asia is really turning toward itself, toward Africa and Latin America, and turning its back to Europe because it is considered that kind of a hopeless case, because the West, that represents 15 to 16% of the world population, is taking inconsistent decisions and unthoughtful decisions that are incompatible with the international relationship, with the international laws, with the UN Charter, and with their own benefit and their own interest.
Indeed. I mean, that's a great point that you make there, somewhat not related to the subject, but a very important one that I want to highlight there, Elijah Magner, and I thank you for that, is that you're looking at 15% of the population that's in the U.S., Canada, Europe, and Australia, but yet 85% of the rest of the world is comprised of the rest of that population. Of course, West Asia being that, and Asia, of course, Africa. Looking at the way that the destructive policy of the U.S. is, Mohsen Naqvi, many terrorist groups are either funded or are in the U.S. Tondar was located in the U.S., in Los Angeles. And I want to raise this point because it's important that during one of the TV channels that this terrorist was addressing a viewer that had called in, threatening the terrorist Sharmad, saying that he's going to reveal who he is or what he's doing. In response, Sharmat says, do you know where the FBI is located? It's in the same federal building where we are in, the center of the FBI, the federal building on the 10th floor. When there's this type of relationship that the U.S. has with these terrorist groups in one way or another, whether it's covertly or behind the scenes, it doesn't even really matter. It's taking Europe down that path. Europe is already now guilty of that. What can be done in order to prevent that? And hopefully for Europe to have its cage rattled and maybe have a reality check on itself.
German leaders and European leaders need to reflect the policy of their own people. They should not reflect or work towards the self-interest of the US. They should work towards their own self-interest. And the proximity of time and space that Europe has to Iran is a lot closer to the proximity that they have with North America. So Germany needs to play it smart. They need to play this Game of Thrones in a diplomatic fashion and not be bullied by the US and its foreign policy. You see, Germany has already too much to worry about with the war in with the war between Russia and Ukraine. Meaning, we already see the kind of implications and effects that war in that region has had on Europe, and there is more to come. So, in these circumstances, for no reason to meddle within the private and sovereign affairs of Iran makes absolutely no sense. And as you have mentioned, that all terrorist organizations in today's day and age find their roots with the CIA or the FBI, may that be Tundar or may that be the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. And this is not something that's even covert. It's quite overt that we see. Bolton is quite open about its funding and their support to these banned terrorist outfits who have been responsible for killing giants in the Islamic Republic of Iran, like Shahid Beheshti, Shahid Bahonar, Shahid Mutahri, for that matter. And the attack on the leader of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khamenei. So, and the very motto and the very objective of these organizations is to fight militarily against the Islamic Republic of Iran. So when we hear about these so-called coups, like the Green Movement that happened in 2008, I believe, and the recent protests that happened against, in which several Basijis were murdered during the Mahsa Amini protests, when we say that these were by the West, it's not a far-fetched idea. It makes logical sense that this is happening.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. We appreciate that, Mohsen Nahfi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. Elijah Magnier, a pleasure. Journalist and political analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapay and the team, it's goodbye.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Limelight.
Millions of Americans will be watching for signs from the Supreme Court justices about whether student debt relief will survive. Many are asking, is President Biden's student debt forgiveness plan now dead? We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. USA Today has covered this story and tells us more. The Supreme Court battle over President Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness plan is about more than debt relief for 40 million Americans. A much more sweeping debate about presidential power will linger just below the surface on Tuesday, 28th of February, as the High Court begins to pick through Joe Biden's $400 billion student debt plan over the course of several hours of oral arguments. The court's decision, expected later this year, could torpedo President Biden's ability to pursue other policies unilaterally, such as on abortion and on immigration. And that could prove tricky for a president who is presumably seeking re-election with a gridlock Congress. It is much bigger than student loans, said Christopher Walker, a professor at University of Michigan Law School. Professor Walker added, "It's about the power of the courts and the power of the president. What the Supreme Court justices signal about that balance of power is one of several long-standing questions the nation's highest court could answer, or at least hint at, as Biden's debt plan gets its day in court." But many are asking, is President Biden's student loan plan dead? President Biden's debt relief plan, the result of a campaign pledge, would forgive up to $20,000 in student loan debt for Pell Grant recipients and up to $10,000 for many other borrowers. The effort has been on hold since a federal court blocked its implementation in October of last year. Millions of American borrowers have had billions in student loan debt erased. Here's how. By the end of the Supreme Court's oral arguments on Tuesday, 28th of February, it may be possible to glean whether an estimated 40 million Americans will ever benefit from that plan. Advocates who support the effort are walking into the courtroom frustrated, but also hopeful. Borrowers want to know the fate of their student loans, said Natalia Abrams, president of the Student Debt Crisis Center, which advocates for borrowers. But the law is on our side, and that is what keeps us going. But the Job Creators Network Foundation, one of the groups challenging President Biden's plan, views it instead as an illegal power grab by the president. If this is allowed to go through, it will give this president and every future president a blank check without any input from Congress or the American people, said Elaine Parker, the group's president. Many are asking, did President Biden overstep his authority with the debt relief plan? Federal courts have clamped down on attempts by federal agencies to make significant policy decisions without explicit approval from Congress. In one high-profile example in June, the Supreme Court invoked the major questions doctrine to strike down tighter rules on power plant emissions. Under that doctrine, courts can invalidate regulations that have a major impact on the economy, are a matter of great political significance, and are not explicitly authorized in the law, though no one is entirely sure how to define those terms. Could student loan debt plan be affected by the end of the COVID emergency? President Biden's lawyers insist the doctrine doesn't apply to the student loan dispute. Federal law, they told the Supreme Court, gives the government power to waive or modify loan rules to help Americans suffering from an emergency such as the COVID-19 pandemic. "We just feel very confident," White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said on Thursday. Jean-Pierre added, "We see this as an important policy that is going to help tens of millions of Americans." But many experts outside the Biden administration are a lot less certain. The law doesn't explicitly discuss a power to forgive loans. No prior administration has read it that way. If the court gets into the major questions doctrine, Professor Walker predicted, President Biden will lose. CNBC has also covered this story and tells us more. The Biden administration is currently blocked from carrying out its promise of canceling up to $20,000 in student debt for tens of millions of Americans while its relief plan heads to the Supreme Court. On Tuesday, 28th of February, the 9 Supreme Court justices will hear oral arguments over President Joe Biden's historic debt forgiveness policy, which has faced at least 6 lawsuits since it was rolled out in August of last year. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear 2 of those cases. The court frequently takes multiple cases in order to deal with all pending disputes at once, said Dan Ehrman, a law professor at Northeastern University. The Supreme Court justice's ruling, which Professor Ehrman believes will come by late June, will settle the matter and decide if more than 30 million Americans with outstanding federal student loans will get debt relief. On 29th of September, six Republican-led states, that is Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and South Carolina, filed a lawsuit against the president's student debt plan, arguing that President Biden was vastly overstepping his authority by moving to cancel hundreds of billions of dollars in consumer debt without authorization from Congress. The Biden administration says that the HEROES Act of 2003 grants the U.S. Secretary of Education the authority to make changes to the federal student loan system during national emergencies. The United States has been operating under an emergency declaration since March of 2020 because of the COVID pandemic. The HEROES Act of 2003 is a product of the 9/11 terror attacks, and an earlier version of it provided relief to federal student loan borrowers affected by the 9/11 attacks. However, the six states in question counter that President Biden's recent loan forgiveness plan is far more broad than the type of modifications permitted by that law. In other words, higher education expert Mark Kantrowitz said the states are asserting that President Biden is using COVID as an excuse to pass his student loan plan. For example, if it was an emergency, why wait 3 years to provide the forgiveness? Kantrowitz asked. Why present it in a political framework as fulfilling a campaign promise? Yet the Biden administration insists that the public health crisis has caused considerable financial harm to student loan borrowers, and that is, debt cancellation is necessary to stave off a historic rise in delinquencies and defaults. The six states also argue that President Biden's plan would cause financial harm to their states, including a loss of profits for the companies that service federal student loans. The second legal challenge the Supreme Court will consider on Tuesday, 28th of February, is backed by the Job Creators Network Foundation, a conservative advocacy organization. Lawyers for the two plaintiffs, Myra Brown and Alexander Taylor, argued they were deprived of their procedural rights by the Biden administration because the White House didn't allow the public to formally weigh in on the shape of its student loan forgiveness plan before it rolled it out. As a result, the lawyers argue, Myra Brown and Alexander Taylor are either part